Welcome to the ASHP Official Podcast, your guide to issues related to medication use, public health, and the profession of pharmacy.
Thanks for joining us in this episode of Research in Pharmacy Practice. This series focuses on discussions for all things related to research, including fundamental, best practices, and practical advice for all those interested in contributing to the advancement of knowledge. My name is C. Michael White from the University of Connecticut, and I'm chair of the ASHP Research Advisory Council. In today's episode, we're going to be chatting with Kevin Gary, who's professor and chair of pharmacy practice and translational research at the University of Houston College of Pharmacy. Dr. Gary is the recipient of the 2023 ASHP Foundation Award for Sustained Contributions to the Literature, a Lifetime Achievement Award, and as such, he has unique insight for both aspiring researchers and mid-career individuals looking to enhance their research impact. So welcome, and thanks for joining us today. Dr. Gary, let's start with a two-part question. When did you first know you wanted to be an infectious disease specialist? And when did that convert to wanting to not only be a specialist, but also a researcher in this area? And the second part's going to be, when did you decide that you wanted to do that in pharmacy school, in residency, or some other time?
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be here, and please call me Kevin. You know, when you look back retrospectively, you probably can see a straight line, but I think when you're going through it, it's probably a series of decisions along the way. It has to do with natural interest and probably mentorship as much as anything. We both graduated with our bachelor's of science in pharmacy. And during my BS, I was always that kid in the class that was saying, why do we do it this way? And that was growing up as well. I drove my parents crazy with sort of the asking the questions. And I always sort of wanted to know like the underlying guts of why we do things, which is interesting. When I was leaving Dalhousie University for my bachelor's, I had in my favorite infectious diseases prof said, you should go to SUNY Buffalo and get a PharmD at the time. And then when I went to Buffalo and got my PharmD, I had Jerome Shentag said, you should go to Cooperstown and do a residency. And then in residency, I was interested in cardiovascular disease, ironically enough, a lot of Coumadin stuff, a lot of pain management, outpatient ambulatory care. And then there was a great gentamicin dosing service also in Cooperstown, New York, where I was doing my residency. I was deciding then whether or not where I'd want to specialize in, and cardiovascular disease was actually one of them. I applied to a few programs, and this group in Chicago, UIC, kind of convinced me they wanted to go there for advanced training in infectious diseases. And while I was there, I became highly engaged in writing and answering unanswered questions and all these sort of things. And so lo and behold, when I was leaving Chicago, I had become a researcher and a researcher within infectious diseases. And I looked all the way back to some of those classes I really enjoyed at Dalhousie, I would say, well, I was always destined to be a ID researcher, but I'm sure there's multiple versions in the universe out there, in the multiverse, where I'm a cardiovascular researcher or an AmCare pharmacist or whatever it might be. But it is a series of decisions to make along the way based on natural abilities and mentorship, I think.
So, Kevin, the one thing that is unique, you know, a lot of people that have ended up doing research in academia have come out, they've done a residency, they've done a fellowship specifically in research. But you took the next step. And when you were hired at the University of Houston, you also sought out and then got a master's degree in biometry. So what is that? And why did you want to go down that path?
Yeah, that's a good, cool question too. So obviously, let's say PharmD, 6 years, residency, a couple more years, and then your fellowship, a couple more years. 6 + 2 + 2 = 10. You're pretty much training as long as most other research-bound persons are going to train. But what you're learning is very, very broad. So when you're going through your residencies, you learn how to take care of patients. And when you're doing your specialty residencies, you're getting very, very deep into your specialty area, still very broad, which gives you this wonderful vision of what's still needed out there. Like your unmet medical need knowledge is as good as anybody out there, I think. And then you transition into a fellowship where you say, I've really now committed to a research career and I want to use my analytical skills and really start answering some of these questions, of which I know there are many. And so then you devote 2 years to that endeavor, but you come out of that then 10 years of training as this really, really strong person and clinical knowledge and know where the gaps are, but a little bit of a deficiency with only 2 years of training in order to build up your toolbox, your methods toolbox of what you want to do to solve those problems. So when I was leaving Chicago, I had done my fellowship in epidemiology, infectious diseases, with a little bit of translational work in the lab as well. But no one's going to talk to me as if I'm a card-carrying biostatistician or I have some sort of advanced research methodology. So I really wanted to tackle the bioanalysis of what I was doing. And for that, I knew I was going to need some more robust methods within biostatistics. And that's going to help me translate the stuff I'm learning in the clinic, the stuff I'm learning in the lab. And really, walking around as a card-carrying statistician has helped me a lot in terms of being able to apply those questions I know need to be answered, but applying them in the right way.
Nice. So this next part of the interview is going to be called Show Me the Money, right? So we all know that grant funding is very important for all researchers, but it's very hard for young investigators to have initial success. So I see that you started out with a very tiny foundation grant from the National Association of Chain Drugstores, and then some modest funding from the pharmaceutical industry. Then you get an ASHP Foundation Drug Therapy Research Award. And then you hit the ASHP Foundation Best Practices Research Award. So now we're talking about 2007 and then 2010 for these two awards. Your funding sources subsequently branch out and include larger foundation awards, and ultimately to federal sources, such as the Centers for Disease Control and the NIH. So how did you start from such humble beginnings and build up to the point that you were able to get some of those very prestigious and much larger funding levels that you were able to get from the federal government?
I think sometimes the scariest part of research and why more people don't dive into the deep end is that concept of grants. It's intimidating. At the very least, and maybe a common theme here, find a mentor that has done it before and ride those coattails for a while. Let them help you get trained up would be words of wisdom every time. Now, what I do enjoy about research and grantsmanship is it's almost like sports. There's the high school team, the college team, the university team, the minor leagues, the big leagues, the Olympics. And it's always a career progression, such that like for me and you, Michael, like we're still like in the game and we're still competing for the next one. And whether we are now at the university level or the big leagues, that's to be determined. But you don't go for the major league fastball to begin with. You slowly build up and there's a whole team out there devoted to junior faculty, new investigator awards, starter grants. Even the pharmaceutical industry loves to pick on the next big one that's coming down the line. And so for me, I concentrated on those grants that I was competing with my same high school team of kids that were going after the similar grants. And that competition is fun. The feedback you get when you don't get one, you have to incorporate into the next one. When you do get one, you celebrate that success. And so as you build up and you have success at whatever playing field you're playing on, that enables you to have the confidence then to move up the ladder to the next one. And that's why a lifetime of research can be so enjoyable, because there's always something to strive for and something to aspire towards. And I think it's a really kind of enjoyable part of the job once you get the first one.
When I first transitioned from pharmaceutical company funded projects to foundation dollars, I had to learn that there was some differences, right? When you were dealing with industry-funded projects, the grant applications were really focused on identifying questions that met an important marketing need that the company had or a regulatory need. While for foundations, the lens from the funders was different and the impact on society became more important. Did you find the same kind of things, and how did you learn to write grants from different perspectives for these different audiences?
You said it very well, and so agree, ditto, and I will just expand on that topic a bit. It's often said when you're writing a grant that you're trying to envision the person reading your grant and then as you're writing simultaneously, it's sort of hard to do that. But as you're typing, I think my buddy Joe was going to be reading this one on the grant review committee, and you're almost writing a letter to Joe saying, "Dear Joe, here's why this is the greatest thing ever." So it's hard to visualize that, but as much as possible, you're trying to, and that's, as you described, the lens. Whatever that lens is, that's who you're writing the grant for, not for yourself.
For me, as I was going through, I always tried to be able to find some different competitive advantages, right? So when you're first starting out, you need to be asking yourself, what is it that I can do for free that'll make it look like I've done something in this area, right? So when you get to that portion of the grant where they're asking you, what kind of research have you done in this research line? At least you could say something. And then how can you build that up to the next step with internal funding? That you can get a small amount of money that shows, well, I do have the ability to recruit patients, or I do have the ability to get information out of this data set. You know, I do have the ability to do some of these techniques, even if, you know, you're not going in and trying to hit a home run, you're just showing them that you're committed to this area. And also that the things that you're proposing that you have the ability to pull off should they give you that level of funding. And, you know, I think that's really important, especially for really large funders. If you're unable to show that you can get smaller amounts of money and that you could manage the budgets well, that you can stay on your timeline, that you can deliver what it is that you want to deliver, it's really, really hard, even if your idea is amazing, for somebody to invest a lot of money into you. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I agree. It's like, a grant is essentially two things. Why is this the greatest question the world's ever seen? And then number two is, why am I the most important person to answer this question? And I think once you have those one, two punches put together, you're all set for grantmanship.
Yeah. I mean, one of the first foundation funded grants that I had, what I did was, you know, I started out by going to a company and I was saying, well, I was going to submit for this foundation grant. Would you give me free drug and placebo? Right. And so then they were like, oh, well, you know, we're not sure that we can do that. I was like, well, would you give me free placebo? Right. So, you know, I guess it's kind of, on the one hand, it would be like, well, does this person have no shame? Right. But what ends up happening is that if they see your commitment and they make that investment in it, now you're able to propose a $30,000 or $40,000 project, even though you're only asking the foundation for $20,000 real dollars. Right. And it allows you to do something that's a little larger. The other thing is that, you know, at my institution, I would go to other researchers and I would try to barter with them. Well, you know, if you let me collaborate with your research nurse and do this, then I'll do this for you on this project, so that, you know, I didn't have the ability to be able to pay for somebody that would have that level of support, but I could barter and use some of my skills to try to get some of those skills, again, trying to get some of those competitive advantages early on.
I was saying, maybe just to get in the add-on, I do see many people want to go get grants before they've built up an accumulation of enough publications. And you have to have the medical writing down. You have to have that skill set down in order to be competitive for grants. But as a paper, a publication is generally a synthesis of data that then you present to the world, and that's great to get it published. And a grant is that, but then it's also kind of the sales pitch, as you're describing. And don't pivot towards a grant until you're very comfortable in the medical writing, because then you'll be able to write it better. You'll be able to send it better. And also, as you're describing, sort of that background, what you've done already, then is there for the grants people to see and to say, oh, they're in the space. Let's give them some money to support that research.
Yeah. So I found that receiving the ASHP Foundation Drug Therapy Research Award was really instrumental in my career. It was kind of a stamp of approval from a major pharmacy organization, and it made it easier for other funders to see me as a researcher on the cutting edge and someone to invest in. So how do you think that pharmacy-specific foundations like the ASHP Foundation Awards that you receive impacted your career trajectory?
I think it's important, and I like the area of the question as well. I kind of go back to my sports analogy a bit. And say it gives you confidence that you can take it to the next level. I think it's important from a personal standpoint for awards, but it's also important from whatever the organization that you're at, and maybe even the community that you're working in, that this area of research is important. And so the ASHP Awards in general, hey, that was a really good paper. That kind of really validates that what we were doing was successful, then you kind of scratch your chin for a second. You say, now, if we do it even better the next time, well, we'll be competitive for that award again, or maybe we'll be competitive for something else, like a larger grant or a New England Journal paper publication or whatever it might be. Sort of that sports analogy of always pushing yourself. And that's another one of these validations that this push is worth it, because good things come for those who try hard. I take a lot of these awards in that vein, that it helped me as a person, helps the organization I represent, and it helps the community at large that I'm part of.
One important feature I see in your research and other successful researchers as well is the ability to identify a research area that seems to have some legs, where you want to devote a 3 to 5 year time period into, so that your prior work can help work for you. Tell me about what your research line is, how it evolved, and some of the important outcomes that you found as you were going through and doing that research.
It's not a straight line again, though in retrospect, it is a straight line, ironically enough. So infectious disease trained, primarily hospital-based trained. And even from the very beginning in Chicago, I was always interested in the interplay between lab-based findings that a research lab might produce or that you could get from the clinical microbiology lab in my particular case, and patient outcomes. Are they having poor outcomes or good outcomes or whatever you could do to influence that? So I started off then, it's always been that. And I started off surgical site infections, a lot of methicillin resistances are coming. So should we change over from cefazolin to vancomycin? And then candida became a big deal with the new echinocandins. And are people not getting appropriate therapy in time? And then I sort of pivoted to C. diff, which is my current focus, just in collaboration with Herbert DuPont, who's a very famous nosocomial diarrhea expert, in all honesty. We had an outbreak of C. diff on our obstetrics ward. And so I was working infection control at the time, doing a lot of work with them. And they brought Bert in as an outside expert. And so we collaborated and solved this outbreak. And also found that this new epidemic strain called the 027 strain was present in our hospital. We published that. And then we sort of said, this was a lot of fun. We enjoyed working together. And our two careers have kind of gone in a little bit different directions, but we still keep in touch often. But that was kind of the nidus that pivoted me away and into my current area. Now, as C. diff has grown and maybe became like more recognizable, and the science behind C. diff has become more attuned to the microbiome and how the bugs change in our gut and they allow C. diff to proliferate, that has allowed me to make friends with a lot of basic science researchers that deal with microbiome, that deal with spore germination, that deal with really subsections of C. difficile. And that has really been a really fascinating area for me to be able to take my clinical knowledge of these people aren't doing well, these people are pretty good. And it could be because of this hypothesis. And it just so happens that that hypothesis, I have a buddy over there as a world's expert in that particular area. And that has really allowed me to grow as a researcher, develop my network, and allowed me to think of like more five-year plans, as you're describing. Well, in the next 5 years, maybe we could discover why these microbiome changes lead to recurrence or not. And I could see a world where I go, well, I wonder if the microbiome is responsible for cardiovascular disease. And you and I collaborate in the future on some sort of hypertension project that has my microbiome knowledge and your hypertension knowledge. Like, I could see that straight line, ironically enough, leading right into your front door, depending how things go.
What it sounds like is that, you know, you're going to grand rounds, you're looking at some websites, you're looking at what kind of seminars are coming up. And then, you know, you're not exactly sure what the potential tie-in would be. But while you're sitting there, in addition to listening as to what's going on, you know, you're thinking about, well, how could my skill set be of benefit to this person? And then in exchange, how could this person's knowledge and experience help to bring my research to the next level? And maybe at the end of the day, you invested 45 minutes and it didn't come to anything. But maybe you found a new collaborator that gave you a new unique ability to do something to be able to face some of the challenges you weren't able to do before.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, science is a team science. Research is a team science. And I think building a team is a lot of the fun of the research and also where you get a lot of the significant results.
There's PhD researchers, you know, and there's MD researchers. What is the unique value of having a pharmacist as a researcher? And what is one of the unique things that you bring to the projects you're working on, to the collaborations that you have?
I'll start off with your grand rounds analogy. I think that's a good way to start. Anyone who's ever been to a medical grand rounds, they will know it's 99% diagnostics. And oh yeah, then we give them penicillin. And oh, well, then that's like all the pharmacists in the room kind of stand up and say, well, what's the dose of penicillin? Should you really choose penicillin or not? I think that focus on drug therapy that a pharmacist brings is truly enlightening in a lot of areas, including research. I will say for a basic scientist, the ability to pivot their research a bit to probably more clinically applicable questions, because you'll generally have this amazing knowledge base of people that just blows your mind at what they can do. But they're applying it after having read the literature or a peripheral understanding of the importance of things. And then having someone like me or you walk in the room that says, well, this is what I see. This is why I think patients are dying or they're not getting better or whatever. And then that pivot to take that methodology into that area has time and time again for me proven to be very fruitful. And I think that's a clinician brain, a clinician researcher. And whether that's a physician scientist or a pharmacist scientist, I see that clinician brain aiding research teams a lot and many times leading research teams.
Yeah. One of the unique things that I've seen is that you've been asked to be on some prominent guideline writing committees. I think that's really important because the impact the guidelines are having on people's clinical practice, not only for pharmacy, but also for all health professionals. So tell me why they contacted you in particular, what unique value you feel that you've provided, and whether you think that pharmacy organizations supporting pharmacist investigators helps to engender greater participation of pharmacists in clinical guidelines.
Well, to answer your last question first, absolutely. More pharmacy representation is great. I want to go for the C. diff guidelines. Thank you to ASHP. When the guidelines committee was being formed back in the early 2010s, I guess now, they reached out to ASHP and they said, hey, do you have a pharmacist in your network that knows anything about C. diff? And if so, could you direct us to that person? And thank you to whoever was back in the job back then said, oh, yeah, I do know Kevin Gary. And I'd given talks at mid-year on C. diff, and I was sort of a recognizable name in the area. So it was pretty logical. And ironically enough, they reached out to another group called SIDP, and I got two invitations for that one because of knowing those persons too. So I guess the take-home message that your network is really important and making sure that your brand is out there is really important too. I will say I was because of that event, I was asked to be on the IDSA Standards and Practice Committee, which is the committee that oversees the IDSA guidelines. And they really looked to me as a pharmacist in terms of like stuff I didn't know anything about. These drugs that were being recommended, are they still the right ones? Are they still available? Is the dose correct? Do we have to put any safety warnings in there that aren't in there? So you don't have to be the world's expert in such and such to provide amazing value into guidelines. Just our base knowledge is something that not everybody's carrying around. Anytime you have the chance of who would like to be on that guideline, whether it's local, national, international, say yes, because you'll always bring value to that just with baseline specialty knowledge in the area.
You then became department head, right? And so when you become department head, now you're not doing things just for you and your collaborators. You have a broader set of goals, right? Trying to direct the entire department and you're in charge of their workflow. And now you're mentoring people that are starting out who want to follow your path, but you know, in different diseases and different disorders, which were not some of your specialties. So in essence, you're responsible for supporting pharmacists across their career continuum, new faculty, older faculty. What advice would you give to pharmacy students who are interested in research careers? And how does it compare to the advice that you give to pharmacy residents, that you've given to fellows, that you've given to graduate students, and now as department head, that you're giving to new faculty and then old faculty? Is it the same speech or are there different speeches for different people?
So it's the same themes. It's mentorship, making sure you have time and interest in doing whatever you're doing, then the time to get that stuff done. So the themes are correct, whether you're entering pharmacy school or thinking of retirement from a pharmacy career. For students, residents, and fellows, and I'll put a caveat on the fellow, ironically enough, too, it's do you really want this type of job? And you have to get your feet wet and see if you like it. You're not going to be doing chest compressions every day when you're a researcher. You're not going to be saving individual lives. But what you can do is have a pretty massive impact on healthcare in our space. So you want to dabble before you go jump into the deep end on that. And the reason why I put a caveat on fellows is a fellowship teaches you amazing analytical skills. It teaches you project management. It teaches you how to take an unknown thing and turn that into an answer. That skill set isn't a research skill set. It's just a really good skill set to have. You're not committing to a lifetime of research as a fellow, but you're kind of steering yourself that way. Once you then jump into a research career, you're kind of stuck. You're going to get going on that. And hopefully you've done enough background research to know that that is the life that you want to lead. It's that same advice that I gave to myself. You start with the small grants. You make sure you're building up a body of knowledge that is important to you and is of interest to others. And then just play ball and see if you make it to the big leagues or not. And just be always striving for the next thing. Generally, good things will happen. Don't think of life as a straight line until you look back on it. Think of pivots along the way of what's important to you and the way that your career is progressing along with the way the field's progressing, and feel free to pivot. It'll look right once you're all done. So that would be kind of how I at least conceptualize things as I'm discussing these things with all those types of people you refer to.
Yes, I was at a pharmacy meeting many years ago, and it was specifically for mid-career people. You know, it was entitled, "I just got tenure, what do I do with my life now?" Right. And so the whole idea behind it was to get people, you know, to think about what comes next. I've also seen a number of researchers who have been in a research area. Maybe they were trained in their fellowship in a certain area. And then, you know, they've had a lot of success, 10 years, 12 years, 15 years. But now those techniques are dying. Funding is drying up. Other things are happening within that space. And it's time to think about or to pivot. But, you know, you're nervous about pivoting because you're going to be, you know, starting over in a way. And what are you giving up and what are you getting? Have you had to navigate making some of those initial changes? And have there been people you've worked with as department head who find themselves in that situation? And what kind of advice do you give them?
A colleague of mine, Vincent Tam, this was a number of years ago too, got promoted to full professor. And in the annual review, we sort of looked at each other, well, what now? Got all the promotions under our belts. What do we do next? We eventually firmed up legacy. As now that's the next step of what do you really want to be known for and who do you want to have mentored and what do you want to have done and that sort of stuff. So there's always progression. And then there's everybody, I think everybody pivots. I've been describing the straight line, but nobody's that. Oh, that's an opportunity. That's a neat opportunity. And I've always thought a good thing to do would be to have like your funding source or your area, but always be thinking of what would be the one other thing I'm going to pivot. And so for me, it's chronic diseases in the microbiome. I just think that's a fascinating area. And it would lend itself very nicely to my emerging knowledge base of microbiome sciences. Now, if I raised my hand and said, hey, I'm going to help control cholesterol, that looks like a massive pivot from what I've been doing. Oh, yeah, no more Lipitor for you because I'm going to feed you Bacteroides. But that would be a very logical pivot for me. Because that's kind of what I'm thinking of doing, and that's an unmet need, and there's a green space out there. So whenever someone says, I want to pivot, like, where's the logical pivot that builds on who you are? You're not truly rediscovering yourself. Okay, yeah, that's a little old in the tooth, whatever method you're using. But in all honesty, go do this thing, learn that new thing, pivot to that thing, and off you go. Make sure the pivot looks logical back to the mentorship again and find a good mentor to help you with that. And then it's the same old stuff again, have enough time to do it. Make sure you have enough protected time to do it, that it's not competing priorities. And that's where I think good department chairs come in to help with those kind of transitions.
Yeah, you know, and I think it's really valuable to know that it's okay to ask for help, right? And it's okay to be at a position where you're looking ahead and things aren't as rosy as they used to be. And then going on a period of discovery and talking to other people and spending some time with the literature and in other tangentially related areas to be able to see what it is you want to do. And one of the things that you were talking about with young investigators, but I think also for people that are thinking about doing this pivoting, is while this is still going on, right, and is still your bread and butter, you're talking about dipping your toe into the water or something else, and then, you know, seeing if you like that. And then if it's something that you hate, then you get rid of it and you dip your toe into another lake and you see if you like that. But if it's something that really resonates with you, it's a growth area, it looks like it's going to have important patient care contributions, it could be something that at a certain point you jump in with both feet and you say, this is now what I'm going to be doing for the next 3 to 5 years.
That's a good way to say it too. I like it. Good analogy.
Great. Well, that's all the time that we have for today. I want to thank Dr. Gary for joining us today to discuss his career and his contributions to research. Now, for you people at home, if you haven't done it before, I encourage you to check out ASHP and the ASHP Foundation's research resources and the Foundation's research grants and awards. We talked about today how those research grants and awards can really help to get you in the game or help to accelerate your level of success. So if you enjoyed today's episode and you want to hear more, be sure to subscribe to the ASHP official podcast for more great content from ASHP.
Thank you for listening to ASHP Official, the voice of pharmacists advancing healthcare. Be sure to visit ashp.org/podcast to discover more great episodes, access show notes, and download the episode transcript. If you loved the episode and want to hear more, be sure to subscribe, rate, or leave a review. Join us next time on ASHP Official.